Congressman Jerry Connolly is my guest in studio. Mr. Congressman, a pleasure to see you. Thank you very much for coming in today. Member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and those committees and Congress as a whole have a lot of issues on its plate as we stand here today.
They're very active committees, I will tell you. We almost practice a philosophy that there's no human problem that cannot be improved with another hearing.
That's true. And the hearing agenda is about to get much fuller through the month of September. We'll talk about some of the things that you'll deal with there. First and foremost on the mind of a lot of your constituents is the federal pay raise issue. President Obama asking for a 1% pay raise on Friday, and yet there's still a possibility there'll be no pay raise. One of the many things that Congress has to decide between now and theoretically the end of September, but we've seen these things stretch, is what that pay raise looks like. What is on your plate when it comes to this, sir?
Well, certainly I support a pay raise. And under the Federal Employee Pay Compensation Act, probably federal employees would be entitled to something of the order of magnitude of about 1.3% when you net out the 0.5% that the law requires. The president's proposing 1%, and while I understand the disappointment that it's so low, the fact of the matter is we're coming off three consecutive years of pay freezes. The real question is whether the Republicans are willing, after 3 years, to consider trying to improve compensation. We know that federal compensation, on average, is significantly below the private sector, no matter what political rhetoric might suggest. And this is a very, very modest attempt at trying to break the pay freeze. I applaud the president for that, because there's symbolism in that and a policy, an important policy, issue that, I think is, needs to be addressed. But, I'm frankly not hopeful that the Republicans are going to budge on this.
You are coming off a very active month of meeting with constituents and hearing what their concerns are and what they're talking about and worried about. A lot of your constituents are federal employees. What are they telling you about their position on whether I might retire early, I might look for employment elsewhere or whatever based on 3 years of pay freeze?
You know, you raise a really good point. I represent the of congressional districts, the third largest number of federal employees. I also, by the way, represent probably the largest single number of federal contract employees. So I face both sets of issues. And all of those constituents are concerned about federal cutbacks and the uncertainty about the budget and the debt ceiling and what it might mean in terms of a potential government shutdown or further contractions in federal investments. I think the biggest single issue I've heard since certainly July 4th is the furlough issue. And I think there's a lot of consternation about that, understandably. I mean, there are some people who are facing the equivalent of a 20% pay cut and the implications long term for their pensions and benefits and their families. You know, and I think this is really something that we have to try to get in front of members of Congress. These are real people with real lives who are doing real service to the country, and it is not right to be singling them out for this kind of action. So, and that, of course, goes back to the failure of Congress to deal with the issue of sequestration. I have voted against the last funding of the federal government in principle, because it baked in sequestration, and I do not support sequestration.
Is it the issue of the way that the cuts are done, or is it the top-line numbers, or some combination of those, or other elements, too?
It is the mindlessness and recklessness of all of that, the number and the way it's done. When you refuse to distinguish between performers and non-performers or subpar performers, that is a very bad management principle. You shouldn't do that in the private sector, and by and large, we don't do it in the private sector, and we certainly shouldn't do it in the public sector. The demoralization that follows from that is profound. The decrease in productivity that follows from that is profound. And, of course, at the federal level, we have a bigger issue. 47% of the current federal workforce, which is several million strong, is eligible for retirement over the next decade. The baby boomers are getting ready to retire. And how are we going to recruit and replace and retain the workforce of the future, especially in the higher skill set, if we're treating the workforce this way? And I find it ironic that a crowd that says we ought to run the government like a company actually is engaged in management practices that no company worth its salt would ever engage in.
You used a couple of terms there that I want to go back to. One of them is uncertainty. And I hear that, as you mentioned, the contracting community. I hear that from them more often than I hear it from folks who work in the government, that they're worried about the uncertainty. They could plan for whatever they knew was coming down the road, but they have no idea what's coming down the road as soon as September 30th of this year.
And you know, when you think about it, if you think about long-term contracts, long-term projects, let me take transportation. I did a lot of work in transportation when I was in local government. You know, transportation projects are very long-term. Look at Rail to Dulles. Rail to Dulles, you know, got started as an idea in 1962. 47 years later, we signed the full funding grant agreement with federal government to break ground. 47 years later. Now, not every project, of course, is that. But large infrastructure projects are usually a 10-year time horizon. Planning, feasibility, engineering, financing, actual construction. And the idea that, for example, we'd only pass a transportation bill for a year extension or two means you can't really make the financial commitment to a long-term infrastructure project. It precludes long-term investment in our infrastructure. Not a good thing for a great country.
Mm-hmm.
And God knows our competition understands that, and they're doing otherwise, China to it. Infrastructure investments all over the place. So that's true in federal contracting as well. You know, you've got a large systems integration IT contract. You can't just make plans on a year-to-year basis. Who do I hire? How many do I hire? What risk do I take? What office space do I let? What kind of equipment do I lease or purchase? I'm not going to make those long-term commitments and then turn to my corporate board of directors or to my investors or my stockholders and tell, or let alone my employees, and say, you know, I'm going to have to let all that go because they didn't renew it or the budget isn't approved. And as a result, you have this insidious, unseen impact of we're going to hold back. And that's happening all over in the federal contracting world and directly in the federal government itself. Agency heads are understandably reluctant to make any kind of long-term commitment for themselves or for their outside contractors.
Another term you used was the concept of retaining federal employees. We talk a lot on this station about recruitment, and you and your colleagues talk about it in Congress too. But keeping the people that we have is much easier than going out and finding new people, and yet that's just as difficult, maybe more difficult, in the environment we're in right now.
Great point. And again, for a crowd that says it wants to save federal tax dollars and make the federal government more efficient, they are actually, in their philosophy and in their actions, making the federal government less efficient and incurring costs that are totally unnecessary in that regard. Because you're right. It's a lot easier to retain the workforce we've got and improve its productivity than it is to have to go out, recruit, train, and try to retain the workforce that replaces it. And that's a very expensive proposition.
Have we ever attached a number to the amount that agencies spend preparing for shutdowns, preparing for all of these catastrophic events that don't ever seem to quite happen?
You see estimates all over the place, but I think it's a safe assumption to say it's certainly in the billions of dollars. And it's worse than that because, again, the House majority, unfortunately, is playing again with the debt ceiling increase. If that leads to another downgrade of the U.S. credit rating, that costs billions and tens of billions of dollars potentially in higher interest rates. Right now borrowing is pretty low. It's a good time to actually borrow money and make investments at almost zero cost long term. And yet we're not taking advantage of that at all. And in fact, we're toying with trying to change that 0 to 1% cost of real cost of money to something much higher. And that's reckless and injurious to taxpayer interest.
If I'm a federal employee, should I take some comfort in the fact, though, that Republicans and Democrats, both sides of the Hill, have said we have no interest in a shutdown and we want to make sure that the government continues to operate after September 30th of this year? Should that make me feel at least a little bit better?
Yeah, I think that should provide some comfort. But, history is replete with incidents that were not planned and that happened even when we said, but that's unthinkable. You know, it's a maybe not an apt analogy, but, you know, you, we if you read Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August, classic work on how we got into World War One, we kind of stumbled into it. It wasn't planned. It wasn't something desired. But people kind of went down a road they could not escape from at a certain point. And, of course, tragedy ensued. So this isn't of that order of magnitude, but it is perfectly possible that because people are entrenched in their positions and their philosophy and their commitments to outside groups like Grover Norquist, that this unthinkable thing could nonetheless happen. And so that's what we have to guard against, and we have to fight back constantly about anybody who suggests, I think we can afford a shutdown. I think a shutdown is a desirable thing. Remember, there are a number of Tea Party-related Republicans who spent August at town hall meetings hearing from their base that a shutdown was a desirable thing. It's an object lesson that is to be desired. You know, in my district, that's a horrifying thought, but that's not true in every district. And so there is a political base that actually would welcome a shutdown.
Are you concerned about the volume of work that you and your colleagues have ahead of you? We're talking about the debt limit. That's mid-October. The fiscal year obviously ends at the end of this month, with not a lot of progress in sight for regular order, certainly is out the window at this point. And all of these other issues seem to be, we're back in this mode where all of these things are happening at once.
Yes, I think governing by crisis is very unwise and frankly injurious to the country. And along the lines we're talking about, it costs money, it creates uncertainty for businesses as well as for the government, for the taxpayers we serve. It's very bad public policy. And of course, putting everything off until the last minute, which has been the habit since the Republicans have come into the majority in the Congress, sadly, is also, I think, very dangerous policy. And then there's the issue of, the reason for that is because we've been so busy and so productive that we had no choice. We've been in session since January. In June and July, we met 8 of those 9 weeks, and we have only passed 18 bills into law, one of the least productive Congresses ever. And about half of those 18 bills are, post office namings. So in terms of substantive legislation, this has been a profoundly unproductive Congress, and we have no excuse for the fact that we've put off these big issues until the end.
One of the big issues that you'll deal with as you and your colleagues get back to work shortly is the Postal Service and the situation the Postal Service is in. You are a member of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, as I mentioned, and Congressman Issa and Congressman Cummings appear to at least be finding some common ground on what to do about the Postal Service. What's your take on the fixes that are floating around for the Postal Service, not just on your side of the Hill, but I talked to Senator Carper last week, and they're working on legislation on his side of the aisle, his side of the Hill, excuse me. But what do you see now that you can support, and what's not available right now as something that you would like to support?
Yeah, I guess I want to maybe refine a little bit what you said. You talked about common ground between Elijah Cummings and Darrell Issa. Actually, there was very little common ground. Darrell Issa put out his bill, and it passed on a party-line vote. Not a single Democrat supported it. The Democrats have gotten behind Elijah Cummings' bill, which I helped write, that I think is a much more thoughtful approach and a more comprehensive approach and less punitive approach than the Republican bill led by Darrell Issa. And so trying to find common ground remains about as sticky a proposition as it was, frankly, in the previous Congress, which is why, at the end of the day, Issa could not bring his bill up to the floor because it was weighted down with so much baggage, negative baggage, whether it was about rural delivery, whether it was about postal worker issues, whether it was about unionization, whether it was about 6 days versus 5 days delivery, on and on and on. The bill died of its own weight.
There were some accounts, though, that he had subsequently adopted some of Congressman Cummings's requests into a new version of the bill that he intends to push forward with. Is that correct?
He made a big deal out of that, mostly for window dressing. And as I said, the Democrats didn't buy it. He didn't get a single Democratic vote, including Elijah Cummings. So if he's sincere about trying to work something, a compromise bill, start over and work with us. And maybe we can find common ground. But Darrell is virulently anti-union. The Postal Service is largely unionized labor. And he had gratuitous provisions in his original legislation that really still stink. I think we really are philosophically stuck on issues like 6 days versus 5 days. So let me, if I may, just go into that. What, you know, someday I'm going to write a book called The Unexamined Thought. You know, a lot of people in this town, including the editorial board of the major newspaper in this town.
You can say the Washington Post on this program,
routinely,
sir. That's fine.
I normally love the Post, but I think on postal issues, they have got themselves locked into a mindset that it remains unexamined and impervious to new data. And so their narrative and Darrell's narrative is, look, going from 6 to 5 days a week has broad public support. It's tough love, but we have to take it. We're hemorrhaging money, and that's why we have to do it. All right, that sounds good. Why wouldn't you do that? And we can live without 6 day delivery. Well, first of all, unexamined thoughts. When the Postal Regulatory Commission looked at the estimated savings, it found that the Postal Service management overestimated the savings by over $1 billion. They also underestimated the lost revenue that follows that by at least $500 million, meaning that the savings was less than $500 million. Now, the Postal Service is losing, you know, $12 to $15 billion a year. This is hardly a dispositive act. And my guess is that the 6 days a week remains a competitive advantage of the Postal Service with respect to the private sector competition. Before you give it up, you want to really examine, can we make that work for us? Now, if at the end of the day we can't and we really can live without it, then so be it. But no such analysis has really been done. It's just a matter of ideology. Let's get rid of it. And we have to. Well, that's an unexamined thought. Well, what do you mean we have to? And I will tell you that it will have implications on journals, on magazines that are mailed weekly. It will have implications for a lot of rural delivery that takes time to get things to people in that 6 day. It will have a profound impact on the greeting card industry that absolutely, you know, you want mom to get Mother's Day card by, you know, before Sunday. Saturday delivery is kind of important if you're one of those few people who kind of waits till the last minute. Parcel delivery. The fastest growing part of new business for the Postal Service is actually generated by the very technology that's decreating business. You get online and order something from Amazon.com or from Macy's or whoever. That package still has to be physically delivered. Who does that 6 days a week? The Postal Service.
Well, and under their plan, they're going to continue to do that, sir.
Well, that they say that. That's right. But you've got to make sure that as a standalone is going to be viable from a financial point of view. And I think the Postal Service and the Postmaster General have really done a very poor job of providing us with cogent analysis, convincing analysis, numbers crunching, if you will, that backs up decisions they want to make. It seems helter-skelter. It seems unjustified. Nobody denies that we have to make reforms in the Postal Service because it is losing money. But we have to better understand, why is it losing money? Where is it losing money? Where is it making money? Where are the opportunities to grow the business? Because there are. I'll give you one. You know, we're on Federal News Radio. Federal parcel delivery is a $350 million a year business. The Postal Service has less than 10% of that business. That isn't going to solve the problem either. But there are lots of markets to be exploited that, frankly, the Postal Service hasn't even lifted a finger to explore.
Yeah, and that one strikes me as particularly problematic, quite honestly, because the Government Accountability Office tells me the reason for that is because the way the contracts are written currently, when the Postal Service competes with them, they can't compete on the same basis as the private carriers because they can't guarantee delivery in a certain time frame with their priority mail product. And that's something that the Postal Service theoretically could change on their own to compete in that space.
That's just a marketing and management kind of challenge that any company or public sector entity, quasi-public sector entity like the Postal Service, ought to be able to work out. We certainly can do better than 7% of the total business.
Congressman Jerry Connolly is my guest. He is the member of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and you are the senior Democrat, the ranking member of the Government Operations Subcommittee. What's your relationship like with your chairman, Congressman Micah?
I give John Micah great credit. He reached out right away after he got that subcommittee, after it was created. We had breakfast. We've had breakfast several other times. He instantly asked what were my interests and wanted to accommodate them. I had a field hearing on the FITARA bill, the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act bill in my district. We followed that up with a hearing on the Hill. And he has given me wide latitude to pursue those interests. He's very respectful of the kind of district I represent. And I've tried to return that respect and support in areas of his keen interest, one of which is the disposition of empty and surplus federal property, for example. So John's been a great partner. He's been very respectful. We've been we have a really good, productive relationship, and I very much appreciate the bipartisan spirit with which he has approached this new subcommittee.
It's good to hear that, because if I were to look at the surface and I would look at your views on issues and his views on issues, I might not necessarily assume, based on the tenor that we hear about on Capitol Hill, that there would be a fit there personality-wise that you gentlemen would get along that well.
You know, philosophically, you're right. We certainly are not necessarily entirely compatible. But I think we've tried to look for areas of common ground. And I think John shares my philosophy that this committee ought to be doing practical, helpful, solution-oriented things as opposed to posturing ideology and blatant partisan political agendas designed to hurt or weaken the present. And I really appreciate that spirit because, you know, if you put aside politics and you put aside sort of other agendas, Lord knows there's plenty of work to be done here to make the government more efficient, to take advantage of some issues we've uncovered that I think have nothing to do with politics, and everyone wins.
You are not ranking member of the sexiest subcommittee on the Hill. I'm looking at the prospectus on the subcommittee.
I think it's among the sexiest there can be. What do you mean?
Management of government operations and activities, procurement, federal property, public information, including the Freedom of Information Act, grant reform. But you're right. This gets at the core of the things that federal agencies, that my audience and your constituents do in their jobs every single day of the week. What do you expect to see on your agenda, both items that you consider priorities and that Congressman Micah considers priorities as you get back to work?
Well, we've looked at some issues that I think actually have enormous potential where we can take advantage of that dry rhetoric on issues that, in fact, I think are fairly sexy. Let me give you an example. We've looked at identity theft in the IRS. 4 years ago, the IRS was coping with about 60,000 identity thefts a year. That is to say, somebody sort of stealing your identity in order to capture your tax refund. That, in 4 years, that ballooned from 60,000 to 1.5 million. We've got a problem. And only 4 people last year were prosecuted for that crime. This is going to affect every American household if we're not careful. And so looking at that issue, seeing what the government's doing to try to deter it, what technologies are needed, what investments, what personnel. Now, trying to get the Republicans to want to prop up IRS in terms of additional resources is always a challenge. But here's a case where a relatively modest investment could have huge payoff protecting the American taxpayer. And it's a cybersecurity issue. There's another issue. You know, every year it's estimated that about $300 to $350 billion a year in taxes owed the federal government is left on the table. $300 to $350 billion a year. That's 3 times the amount of annual sequester. And over 10 years, that's $3.5 billion. Now, if we can make a dent in that, we're not raising anyone's taxes, we're not slashing critical investments, but we are taking in revenue that in fact is owed us by making the IRS more efficient. If we starve the IRS, we're never going to be able to do that. So, philosophically, the difference between John Mike and myself comes into play there, but I think John recognizes it's a real issue and that sooner or later we're going to have to tackle it and that there's payoff, real payoff, and hurts nobody except those who are sort of avoiding their taxes.
At some point, it seems to me, that becomes just a straight-up ROI issue, where you demonstrate if we spend this much, we get this much in return to go toward relieving these other areas that we agree.
I completely agree with you, but I have to tell you, ideology comes into play here. The Republican ideology, not everybody, but most, precludes that kind of investment and therefore that kind of ROI because in their narrative, the IRS is a big bad government boot on the neck of the American taxpayer and should be starved and limited and constrained and disinvested in. And that's just a sort of mindless rhetoric, as far as I'm concerned, that gets in the way of our trying to make the government more effective and more efficient on behalf of the American taxpayer. Because if you're not paying your taxes, it puts more of a burden on me when I pay mine. And everybody should be paying their fair share after we've determined what that fair share is.
Based on your view of that view of the Internal Revenue Service, we should probably, on your broader committee assignment on oversight and government reform, expect to hear the names Lois Lerner and William Wilkins a lot more this fall.
Yes.
I know you're not crazy about that idea.
Yes, but let me add a third name, and that's J. Russell George. I think has comported himself in a thoroughly unprofessional manner. I think serious questions have been raised about his integrity in our hearings. He testified under oath in testimony that could only and charitably be characterized as deliberately misleading based on subsequent facts. And I think his credibility as a witness is very much in doubt. Why is that important? Because he was the peg on which Darrell Issa and the Republicans, you know, hung the whole case about the IRS deliberately singling out conservative groups, Tea Party groups, and going after them. We now know that is patently false. They fell back on, well, all right, maybe some progressive groups were also included, but they didn't go after them in depth. We now know that's patently false. They most certainly did. They even denied tax-exempt status to some of those groups. And so now we have to go back to what was the IG doing? The idea that an IG plays a partisan role and colludes with one side of the aisle or the other to create a false narrative in order to for political purposes to try to embarrass an administration is outrageous and clouds the integrity and credibility of all IGs in the federal government. We can't have that. And Mr. George is going to be accountable. And needs to be.
Other than, though, what you just did, which is explain, make your case very eloquently, not just in environments like this, but also in the hearing room, as a member of the minority, what can you do right now?
Well, I think there's a lot we can do in terms of our own independent examination. A lot of documents have been made available to us, and I will simply point out whistleblowers blow both ways. And there are a number of people who have been talking to the Democratic side of the aisle about Mr. George.
Do we have any sense of a timeline?
If the Republicans want to continue to pursue their narrative and their use of the committee on the IRS, the Democrats are prepared to respond vigorously, forcefully, and with facts.
I understand. We'll leave that topic there for right now. You're also a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and, of course, the topic of Syria is on the minds of a lot of people. Where are you? What is your view of the events that have taken place, especially over the past 2.5 weeks, but also over the past 2.5 years, as we've seen events change in Syria, Syria going from someone who we reached out to and had a relationship with to a country that now is dramatically different?
I have been very reluctant to provide arming and training for the insurgency, not because I in any way favor the regime of Bashar al-Assad, but because the insurgency itself is pocked with jihadist fundamentalists, even maybe al-Qaeda sympathizing elements. And if somebody can point out to me, you know, a methodology whereby we can just separate the crowd, so they're on one side of the guys with the white hats, we'll arm them and we'll train them. And then the guys with the black hats, we won't. And oh, by the way, when we do train and arm the guys with the white hats, they won't allow any of that weaponry and equipment to get into the hands of the guys wearing black hats. Then I'm all for it. Unfortunately, obviously, that's not the situation. And that's why the president, who's taken some criticism for it, has been reluctant to do that, and I think he's right. I think nobody will thank us if we blindly go in to Syria and support anyone who's an insurgent as long as they're anti-Assad, And then we have an outcome a la Afghanistan after the defeat of the Soviets through the Mujahideen, which provides a safe haven for all kinds of terrorist elements, including al-Qaeda, that led to 9/11. We don't want that outcome. And so we don't have easy options, you know, long term. And that's why the 2.5 years, I think, have been difficult ones. And I agree with the president's prudence and caution. This is different. Syria decided to call our bluff on what the president called a red line and deployed massive chemical weapons against its own people in the suburbs of Damascus in a stubborn neighborhood that it was a pocket of opposition to Assad. And killed at least 1,400 to 1,500 people, 400 of them children. Now, the ban on the use of chemical weapons has been pretty much an international norm for 100 years, since World War I. It has been violated very rarely. Even Adolf Hitler understood there were consequences from doing that. We cannot, it seems to me, stand by and do nothing unless we're willing to accept the consequences of doing nothing. Now, what are the consequences? The consequences are that Iran looks at that as it's developing its nuclear capability and says there will be no consequences for proceeding with impunity. You know, Pyongyang in North Korea looks at it and says we can do our saber rattling and we can do our own nuclear development program and missile development program with impunity. And, you know, bad guys in the region like Hezbollah, likewise, can say, give us some of those weapons because there will be no consequences if we use them, whether it's against people we don't like in Lebanon or whether it's against Israel proper. And those are real consequences we have to face. Now, the president has said it's going to be a limited strike, a targeted strike. The resolution that the White House has presented to Congress is more open-ended than that, and it has to be brought, you know, I think, refined so that it reflects the narrow goals the president himself has set. If we can do that, I think he has a fighting chance to get it through Congress. This is a moment of truth for Congress. Lots of members on both sides of the aisle have been saying the president should come to Congress before he, you know, making powers in the Constitution are crystal clear. Presidents since World War II have exceeded their powers and ignored Congress, and that's why the War Powers Act was adopted. But even that is a bit of a fig leaf. Well, this president has called a bluff. He's the first president since FDR to come to Congress saying, okay, authorize it. And in a crystal clear, unambiguous way, you authorize it and we'll do it. And so this is going to be, as I said, a moment of truth. It's not an easy issue for members of Congress, not an easy issue for me. I think the overhang of Iraq is pervasive. The fact that we had a president and a secretary of defense and a security apparatus that either didn't read intelligence correctly or deliberately misled on the intelligence with respect to weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein, I think has a profound, profound legacy and is very much influencing the debate that's going on right now. We have to understand, however, Syria is not Iraq. And frankly, President Obama, who is trying to end wars, not start them, is not George W. Bush. And we're going to have to really understand what is the proper analogy here. It's not Iraq. It is, in my view, more Serbia, Kosovo, Bosnia.
The most reasonable criticism, reasoned criticism that I've heard of the president's comments and his approach over the weekend was that he's essentially tipped his hand and Assad now has a period of time, however long that may be, until you and your colleagues take this resolution up to move what he needs to move in such a way that whatever we do won't be particularly destructive. It'll certainly ring his bell a little bit is the term that I heard used over the weekend. Is that a fair criticism, do you think?
I suppose there is that risk. I will point out Syria is not a very big country. And I think that the targets have long ago been developed in Syria. I also don't think it's that easy to be moving tons of dangerous chemical and biological weapons around the country to hide them. And I believe our own surveillance capability will allow us to monitor that. So I don't think that's an enormous risk, but I think it is something of a risk. The president decided, however, that he would be willing to take that risk, however modest it may be, in exchange for having the concurrence of the United States Congress, the people's representatives. In a democracy, I think he's to be applauded for that action.
You're a member of the Subcommittee on Middle East and North Africa. Do you see any potential, dominoes, unintended consequences of what happens in Syria or what doesn't happen in Syria if Assad stays in power there in that region of the world?
The president has said that he believes that ultimately the disposition of Mr. Assad and his government has to be a function of international negotiations, that it doesn't lend itself to a clear-cut military resolution. He's probably right in that regard. I think the events of the last 2.5 years you brought up, that's a long time, probably make that point. Having said that, I think there is broad agreement that Mr. Assad has to go. I mean, he has very few allies. Iran and Russia are two of them. But pretty much the rest of the Arab world, the Islamic League, NATO partners, and other actors in the region would agree that he's a problem and has to go. But he has to be replaced, it seems to me, with a government that is going to be open to democratic reforms and democratic institution building. That's the nub. I mean, how do we get there? And how do we ensure that that's the outcome? And I don't know that anyone has a crystal ball that can tell you accurately how we're going
to
do that.
Because we expected to see that in Egypt, and of course we're in a completely different place in Egypt than what we thought we were a year, 2 years ago.
Revolutions always begin with great hope and expectation. Most of them do not end very well. The American Revolution is an exception.
And you you represent part of the country that was the home to the American Revolution. You're fortunate to do that. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit if we have a chance. I want to spend some time, though, on the S word. You mentioned it earlier, and it's probably the most unpleasant word in Washington, and that's sequestration. We stand a couple of weeks away from this another round of sequestration. The Defense Department this time is saying we're going to be a little more prepared because nobody expected sequestration to happen in January. Nobody expected it to happen in March. It did. And we're now looking at another year of sequester in 2014. Do you see a way forward at this point? We've talked a little bit about the relationship on both sides of the aisle and both sides of the hill, but that seems to be really the crux of where finding some kind of a solution to sequestration is going to be.
I think it's going to be very difficult because of where the new core of the Republican majority is. Elections have consequences. The 2010 election had profound consequences. A number of Republicans were elected on the Tea Party banner. And inter alia, that banner said, gotta rein in the federal government, gotta cut way back in federal investments, federal spending, and do it without any raising of taxes. Now, if you look at what happened earlier this year, the fiscal cliff deal, which originally, Speaker Boehner had said it's going to be a dollar-for-dollar deal. Every dollar raising the debt ceiling, not the fiscal cliff, excuse me, the debt ceiling deal, will be accompanied with a dollar of federal spending cuts. He backed away from that so much that the deal became, we're willing to lift the debt ceiling entirely through May 19th, provided that members of Congress pass a budget. And if they don't, they lose their pay. Well, so you'll note, not a dime of spending cuts, even though there could have been a deal. Boehner walked away from it. There was a deal that had entitlement reforms and spending cuts on the part of the president and the Democrats. Boehner walked away from that. So zero spending cuts. Likewise, in the fiscal cliff deal, you know, if we're going to allow any of the Bush tax cuts to expire, it's got to be accompanied by you know, some kind of deal on the other side in terms of spending. Ultimately, because the Republicans couldn't reach an agreement on that, you know, with overwhelming Democratic support and some Republican support, the top income tax cuts were allowed to expire. And by the way, it worked. It brought in $600 billion of new revenue, and by God, the deficit has fallen to about 4% of GDP from a high of 10 just three and a half years ago. But no spending cuts. So if you're a Tea Party member, you are now frustrated beyond words. Where can we get spending cuts? Well, sequestration, you don't have to do anything. Just let it happen. You don't even have to vote. And it's not just spending cuts. It's $1.2 trillion of spending cuts. And the Tea Party folks, unlike some of the older bulls in the Republican caucus, frankly don't distinguish much between defense spending and non-defense spending. It's all spending. And so they got what they wanted by allowing sequestration to kick in. And I don't know. Can we move the center of the Republican caucus? Can they look at consequences and say, hey, that's hurting my local community. It's hurting defense preparedness. It's hurting long-term investments in the country. I find most of that crowd to be pretty impervious to those arguments.
Now, we talked a little bit before we went on the air about the fact that there are some members of the Republican caucus, even the Tea Party members, that you have good personal relationships with. Is there any place that you see that you and your colleagues on the Democratic side can work with them, maybe not even at the leadership level? Maybe it's a one-on-one or a small group to move somewhat in their direction or to try to pull them over in your direction and talk about some of the things that you did, the impacts on their personal districts and those kinds of things. And the reason that I ask that is to go back to the uncertainty piece that we talked about and how this uncertainty is hurting federal employees and it's hurting planning and operations inside the agencies. Is it your sense that there are some members that are willing to hear that argument?
I think the answer to that is yes, and I think we have to continue to work at it. I got in government to try to get things done and to find common ground, even with people who might philosophically disagree with my view of the world. But I don't think you can underestimate or wish away the profound, fundamental chasm between the new base of the Republican Party and where Democrats are. Democrats believe government has a role and that it can be a very productive and positive role in protecting consumers, in protecting the environment, in playing traffic cop to make sure that businesses operate in a fair way, whether it's protecting consumers or just making sure that, they operate in an openly competitive way and don't fix prices and so forth. So there's a role for federal government, whether it's regulation, whether it's actually being a prime economic driver to protect the economy, as we witnessed these last few years and so forth. I really believe that the Tea Party introduced a real radical element into the Republican caucus that says something quite different. We actually don't believe in government. We believe, it ought to be minimal. We believe it can't do anything right. We believe anything that takes it down a peg is a good thing by definition. Cause it's just more alcohol for the alcoholic. And trying to then engage with somebody who believes that we need to do this. This regulation is a good one. This protecting your constituents as well as mine is less of a compelling argument to those folks than you might suspect. Hmm. And so that chasm, that philosophical chasm, is very real, and it's reflected in the country. And until and unless voters decide that they want a consensus, that's more one or the other, we're going to continue to have these kinds of fights and this kind of gridlock. And I think it does reflect divisions in the country. I mean, in my district, there might be one point of view. You and I were talking about Trey Gowdy, and who's a friend of mine in South Carolina. I think his constituents have a very different view about the government and what he ought to be doing about it than my constituents do about me and the government.
Is it your sense that, I'll just use that as an example since you mentioned his name, is it your sense that most of the folks that you deal with on the other side of the aisle look at it the same way that you do, that they're looking at you and saying, I don't agree with much that Jerry Conley stands for, but he's not doing it just because he thinks it's a great idea. He's representing a piece of Northern Virginia who believes what he believes and sent him to Congress to represent them because those are they believe in what he's doing and he does what they want him to do. Does it go both ways? Is it your sense?
It can. And I've actually had feedback from some of my colleagues who say that, who acknowledge that on the other side of the aisle. I like how you approach it. I don't agree with you, but I think you've done it respectfully, and I like, how you do it. Whether that's just anecdotal or whether that characterizes a broader perspective, not only about me but about others who have a different philosophy, I don't know. It takes a while sometimes. If you've been elected, to go to Washington and shake it up and do radical things and get that government under control and bring it down, downsize it, right size it. They're all bureaucrats up there and, they're sort of stereotypes about federal employees and federal government. I think, it's awfully hard to try to get yourself educated and to appreciate things are far more nuanced than that kind of simple view of the world. And, oh, by the way, who will reward you for embracing the nuance and going back home saying it's not quite everything we thought it was? You'll be challenged in a primary. And that's a palpable fear in the other side of the aisle right now. And there are plenty of examples to show what can happen to you if you stray from sort of a more narrow, rigid line about these subjects.
I know you're not in the business of handicapping Republican politics, but it's interesting to me the concept that you bring up, because I wonder if the 2014 election might be kind of the verdict on that approach. I see a lot of accounts in the Capitol Hill news sources about that very concept, members of the Tea Party who are going home to their districts and saying, you know what, I've been here now for 3 years, and it's not as simple as it looks from the outside. This is a lot more complicated than I thought. And having the same challenge trying to explain that to their constituents, it just doesn't work the way we thought it did.
I wouldn't read too much into the 2014 elections, to be honest with you. First of all, redistricting means this is probably not going to be huge change. There doesn't seem to be any kind of wave building at the moment for those elections. I would contrast that with the 2010 elections. In 2009, you could, by this point, you definitely could feel a wave building from a Democratic point of view, not a good one. I don't sense on either side of the aisle that kind of wave building right now. So more of the status quo, I think, is likely, especially given the built-in advantage Republicans have because they mastered redistricting quite skillfully after the last census. Now, the Senate, I think, is at risk, but not because of a political wave, but because the geography is red. You know, there are three seats that almost certainly the Republicans are, at least right now, likely to win because of Democratic retirements in red states, solidly red states that are likely to vote that way in a midterm election. And then there are three other very competitive seats, also in red states, that are going to be very hard for Democrats to defend. Now, is that a statement by the voters that they're ratifying Republican philosophy? No. I think it's purely an accident of geography in terms of what's happening in 2014 in the Senate. And, oh, by the way, I think you also have to keep in mind that the electorate in a midterm election is radically different than the electorate of a presidential turnout. I'll give you an example. In Northern Virginia, you know, I won my election in 2008 with President Obama on the ballot by 41,000 vote margin. Same district, 2 years later, when I was the only thing on the ballot and the atmosphere was just toxic for Democrats, I won re-election by 981 votes. 2 years later, in a slightly redistricted district last year, I won re-election by 61,000 votes. Turnout matters, and it's an entirely different electorate. So we're likely to hear from a more conservative, elderly, white electorate in a midterm than we're going to in a presidential turnout.
But there's an implication there for sequestration and what my audience and your constituents who work for the government have to live with for the next 2 to 4 years and beyond.
You know, it is very frustrating when folks sometimes act against their own interest. Look at the senior citizen population, which voted pretty heavily for, in a large number, a majority, voted for Romney Ryan last year. They voted for a ticket that wants to voucherize Medicare and would support privatizing some of Social Security. Those are things that are anathema in the senior community. And you would think that, you know, there'd be a connection, a correlation between voting pattern and issues. And there isn't always as much as there should be. And that's a function of how well we get the message out, how well the Republicans tailor their message. And other issues that the electorate may have. So, you know, I'm worried about Social Security and Medicare, but I don't like that Obamacare, even though it may be benefiting me. But I've been persuaded on Fox News that it's, spawn of Satan. And so sometimes voters even can vote against their own interest. And I think the burden falls on us to make sure we're doing our messaging properly and getting that word out and educating the electorate and engaging the electorate in a way that's better than certainly we did in 2010.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I have to give you some credit. I think you deserve a tremendous amount of credit for doing something that a lot of your colleagues in politics wouldn't do, and that's put yourself in a position to make a fool of yourself. You are participating in an event on September 18th that I am very much looking forward to seeing. Tell me about what you're going to do at this spelling bee.
The National Press Club Foundation has revived something last done when Woodrow Wilson, I think in 1913, was in the White House. And that is to have a spelling bee. They're going to sell tickets and raise money for charity. And they've got 10 members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, senators and congressmen, and 10 members of the press. I don't know all of the members of the press, although I know Karen Tumulty from the Washington Post is one of them. And we're going to be competing with each other. And so that should be fun. I don't know that it, I hope I won't make a fool out of myself. I'm brushing up on how to spell potato right now.
Well, we're going to put some information about that at federalnewsradio.com, and I wish you the best of luck with
Thanks
that.
Thanks so much. I think that's September 18th.
It is indeed at the press club. And Congressman Connolly, thank you very much for
My
being
great
here
honor.
Today.
Thanks so much for having me.